Hey, David. How come she hasn't got Jesse Foster?
Oh, she introduced him at Harrington. Yeah, might be good.
If I can have your attention, hi, Therese. If I could have your attention, why I'd like to get started here. My name is Jack Fuller. I'm your representative from this area. I'd like to introduce many of our guests that are here. And if you don't mind, at least raise your hand if you can't stand up in these so people can see who you are. First, I'd like to introduce John Williams, who is the commissioner on Limited Entry Commission. And Ella Anagick, Limited Entry Study Group from Juneau. Linda Fagerstrom, who you all know. Maybe she's doing the dishes yet. She fed us breakfast already, but she'll be here shortly. From Rural Cap. Ron Miller of Limited Entry Commission. And Jack Kineheader of the Limited Entry Commission Study Group. In the resources people, we have Edna Apotiki, who is the coordinator of the Limited Entry Seminar and my full-time right-hand man at Juneau. Dave Hoffman, who is my legislative assistant in the subsistence, Special Committee on Subsistence, who probably some of you know, he was down here on this herring thing. I'd like to introduce, is Henry here? Henry Ivanov, our city manager. There he is. I thought you might have snuck out the door there, Henry, on me. And is Herbert here? Okay. Also, I'd like to introduce somebody to you from down below, Jesse Foster. And Jesse isn't here for limited entry, but he's a real fine resource man on herring. And sort of one of those hardcore guys that a little guy from a small village stood up and tackled the whole bureaucracy. And I'm happy to say he won. He's got a lot of scars to prove it, though. I'd like to just go over some of the goals of this meeting, why we ask you to be here today. These are the goals that we set up for these limited entry seminars. We've just finished one in Kotzebue and Nome, and of course we having the other one here in Uniclete. One was to have the Limited Entry Commission educate the people about the commission, its laws, and the permit system. I know that we've all been living under it for a few years, and no matter how close we are to it, we all got a lot of questions about it. And today is the time to lay them out on the table. That's why I asked John to come to these meetings. I think it, the farther we are away from the flagpole, the tougher it is to get answers and so forth. So we've got the head gee right here today. So we can lay all the questions we have on John, and I'm sure that he'll have all the answers. If he doesn't, why, we'll use the old Army slogan, I'll find out for you. Okay? Also, we wanted to educate the Commission on Northwest Alaska commercial fisheries and problems that they may be facing with limited entry. The third goal was to come up with the solution to the people's problems with limited entry, and of course, that's the biggest one. That's why you're here. To look into what kind of statistics Fish and Game use for fishery and what years they base their statistics relating to the fisheries. To find out the optimum number of commission came up with in determining how many fishermen permits zero to so on would be allowed in Northwest Alaska and still be able to properly manage the fishery. And the last was to include all the fishing villages for this seminar in Kotzebue and Norton Sound. Of course, we don't have the money to make that a reality, that we could have one in every village. But I have, Edna and I just finished going into Stebbins, St. Michael, and Kotlik and having a little mini hearing with the people, just like we're having a big hearing here with you. And we will be bringing some people in from the villages, but there wasn't money enough to bring everybody in. I would just like to say that I hope you'll feel comfortable here today, and I hope that John will feel comfortable here today, that we can really lay these problems out. Don't hold anything back. Let's get it all out here and see if we can't maybe make John aware of some of our problems, and maybe he can educate us into some of the ones we might even cause ourselves. Without any further gabbing, I'll turn this over to John, and we'll get on with it.
Thank you very much, Representative Fuller. These seminars, of which this is the third, were organized by Representative Fuller and his staff as education programs, both for us to have a chance to explain to you why we do some of the things we do, and to hear your problems, as he explained to you. Especially the session that we had in Nome was very, very good, and we had a number of questions, probably half of them from Jesse Foster. I'm glad he's here again today. Rather than give a very long introduction, I would rather that I keep my introduction fairly brief, and then Ron Miller, who is the gentleman here, is a hearing officer and attorney for the commission. He and I will try to explain some of the procedures or answer some of your questions. And hopefully we can use the question and answer process to find out the sorts of things that you people want to know about, rather than going through a long speech about what the commission does. I would ask if some of you are here because you have particular questions about your application, questions of a very personal nature that apply only to you, that you try to talk to Ron or myself during a coffee break or directly after the session, and we can talk to you one-on-one at that time rather than bother everybody with your own personal problems. We do have some information here, and hopefully we'll be able to give you assistance if you need it. Very briefly, the Limited Entry Commission in 1976 established an application process for Norton Sound, along with the other four fisheries in what we call the AYK area, Arctic Yukon Kuskokwim area. And the maximum number of commercial fishermen that was set at that time for Norton Sound was 195. If you fish anywhere in Norton Sound and you get a permit, that allows you to continue fishing anywhere in the Sound. The application process was based upon a point system, and if you got 10 points, you automatically got a permit. I think that we've issued somewhere around 175 of those 195 permits that will be issued. That means that there are still 20 more permits to be issued. We aren't exactly sure which people are going to get those yet, because there are still some people that are in the process that are having more evidence sent in or having hearings with one of our hearing officers. We do know that there are 19 people classified at 9 points as of the last information that we have. And it would seem very possible that many of those people will also eventually get permits. Besides doing entry limitation, which is clearly one of the commission's major functions, we also issue all of the commercial licenses for all fisheries except crewman licenses. Crewman licenses are commercial fisherman licenses. We don't handle those, but we handle all other licenses. If you're going to fish herring, you have to apply to us to get what we call an interim use permit to fish herring. For any commercial fishery, if you're going to operate the gear, the license is purchased from us. We have brought with us a number of copies of a number of the forms that the commission uses. We use them for vessel license renewal, commercial license renewal or purchase, for emergency transfers of permits or permanent transfers of permits, If you lose your card, if you lose your permit card or lose a vessel sticker or something like that, we have a form that allows you to request a duplicate and allows you to keep fishing without losing fishing time. All these things we'd like to go through with you sometime today. And that's, other than answering your questions and conversing with you, that's most of what we'd like to do is try to explain some of these fairly complicated forms.
John, one thing, can you run down the points of the 10 points? I know that most of the people that have been fishing a while understand it, but for the benefit of a lot of people in the villages and other areas, how they arrived at those 10 points in the years that this happened. Could you do that?
Yeah, I'll start it out.
Is that getting ahead of you?
No, it's fine, if that's something that's of interest. I'll start it out, and then I'll let Ron explain the major portion. The years that the Commission considered in terms of point years were 1970 through 1975. If you had fished any time commercially from 1960 to 1975, you were eligible to apply for a permit. But the only years that you fished that you got points for were 1970 through 75. And the law that the legislature passed directs us to consider past participation in a fishery. In other words, you had a license and you landed fish, made money. You consider past participation on one hand, and you consider the economic dependence of that fisherman on that fishery on the other hand. And the point system has 12 points for past participation and 12 points for economic dependence. So there was a possible total of 24 points in the AYK fishery. The Commission determined that anybody who got 10 points or more would automatically get a permit under a provision of the law which said that if you were at a level of maximum economic hardship, meaning in this case 10 points or more as we interpreted it, then you would automatically get a permit. So that's why people with 10 points or more are getting them now, and people with 9 points aren't yet. They're still fishing on interim permits. But we may end up giving permanent permits to people with 9 points just so we can give out the total 195.
So you've got 2 points a year from 70 to 75?
I'll let Ron explain the specifics of the year to year.
Okay.
Thank you. Excellent. The participation points, John, were 16, and the economic dependence were 8. That's how you get the 24. And in the Norton Sound fishery, the participation points were structured on the following basis. For 1970, if you fished as a gear license holder, you got 1 point. 71, you got 2 points. 72, 73, and 74 were 3 points each year. In 1975, you got 4 points. And the 8 points for income dependence or economic dependence were broken down into categories of income dependence upon the fishery. If you had in excess of 60% of your income from the fishery in the years 1974 and 1975, then you got 2 points for 1974 and 4 points for 1975. If your income dependence was only in excess of 30%, then for those 2 years, 1974 you got 1 point, and 1975 you got 2 points. You also got a point for ownership of vessel or gear, and a point for your domicile. So if you lived in Unalakleet as of the end of 1975, then you got 1 point under a classification titled Availability of Alternative Occupations. The Commission felt that those individuals who lived in a rural part of the state were more likely to be dependent upon the fishery as their only occupation, as opposed to someone who, say, lived in Anchorage or Fairbanks, where there were more jobs in the off-season. That's the basic point scheme. And as John said, the Commission determined that 10 point was the limit for Norton Sound, for a fisherman to show maximum economic dependence on the fishery.
Yeah, I have a question in regards to the number 195 was selected to be for the Northern Sound area. And the Kuskokwim Yukon has over 400 some permits. And
can you give your name, please? For
Henry Ivanov. And they have over 400 some permits for that area, and that's river fishing. And this is an ocean, North Sound area, and we have 195. Why?
The maximum numbers were selected mostly based upon historic levels of effort. I have some papers here that show that in Norton Sound, in 1970, there were 104 commercial fishermen who made landings. In 1975, there were about 188, as best as our data can tell us. So we would go to Fish and Game and say, is the historical effort, in other words, the number of fishermen, is that so high that it endangers the escapement of salmon? And if they said that it was not, that they could manage it in such a way as to maintain escapement, then we would try to issue it the maximum that was, or the number that was equal to the high historical effort. Now, we actually, our data was cleaned up a bit after the regulations were adopted. So in Norton Sound, we actually are issuing 7 more permits than were ever fished in any one year. On the Lower Yukon River, on the Lower Yukon, the 1975 effort was 715 people made commercial landings. In Kotzebue, there were 247 people in 1975 that made landings. So the Norton Sound was based upon the historical information.
Yeah, there's a fact too also that the fishing has been just developed and we haven't participated that long, so that was why the figures were so low.
Well, at the same time though, in Norton Sound there was a 100% increase in the number of fishermen in 5 years, from 104 to 190. So if that increase were to continue, it wouldn't be long before the Fish and Game Department could not confidently manage the fishery and maintain escapement levels. The AYK fisheries didn't come under limitation at the same time that the other state salmon fisheries did. The other salmon fisheries were based upon your participation originally up through 1972, and then the Supreme Court said that you must go up through 1974. But the point system was based upon years of fishing from 1960 to 1972. The commission allowed the AYK fisheries to continue to develop for another 3 years, and at that time it was felt that the commercial effort was sufficiently high that it should be limited to make sure that there was enough fish for escapement and to assure that there were enough fish for subsistence use.
Yeah. Question I'd like to ask John, you just pointed out that was a large increase in commercial permits over a short period of time. Do you have any idea where that most of that increase came from?
Well, based upon the permits that we've issued, it would appear that in the AYK region that more than 90% of the commercial fishermen that have received permits are residents of their areas.
Well, 95%. What I was specifically trying to point out, maybe that a lot of these came out of the Nome area where there's very little really strong fishing efforts. And I was wondering if you have any kind of data on that.
Jack, have you broken that down yet with your studies? We haven't broken it down within Norton Sound or the various. We'd have to do a zip code search of our computer files to do that, Jack. It could be done if you're interested.
I thought maybe you might just have that.
No.
So you said that the Fish and Game felt that they couldn't really take care of make sure that they had enough escapement of fish for a number of fishermen. I wonder how they can justify that, having that number in the Kuskokwim Yukon when they're in the river and they're concentrated going upriver. Seems like they'd have more of an impact than Norton Sound would.
You're, what you're saying is basically true. That's correct. The Fish and Game recommendations regarding our maximum numbers, they actually suggested that we cut them down significantly. And we asked, through a series of questions, we asked them if it would be possible to manage the fishery at these higher levels than they wanted. And they said, yeah, but it would be, you know, with lots of closed times and short openings. So we felt that initially it would be better to get more permits out, and then if it was determined in the future that an optimum number of permits would be less than what we'd initially issued, we could institute a buyback program and buy back down to a reasonable level. The Yukon, Kuskokwim and Yukon commercial fisheries are river fisheries, but the size of the stocks are much larger than here in Norton Sound or Kotzebue Sound.
There has been an steady increase in the 200-mile limit in regard to the number of fish that are returning. Would the commission be looking at that at a later date of maybe increasing the number of permits that they'll be issuing if there's a substantial amount of fish that return?
The statute, as passed by the legislature, says that if there is a long-term change in either the biological aspects or the economic aspects of the fishery, then the commission can adjust either upward or downward the number of permits. If it turns out that the high seas Japanese fishery, we're taking a lot of fish from this area, and your runs increase significantly over an extended period of time, we could adjust upward the number of permits, so long as it did not impact the economic return of the fishermen and Fish and Game could handle the harvest levels, harvest effort.
Thank you.
But John, what is this extended period of time?
Well, more than just one life cycle. The chum salmon are on a 4-year cycle, 3, 4, 5 year, and king salmon are, I guess, 4, 5, and 6 year cycle. So we would have to look at more than just one cycle. We'd probably look at 2 cycles or so.
Bob Rubin, but in the statute, doesn't it allow also for like any increase in fishing coming through? Wouldn't that be taken up with an increased technology as well, as far as gear? And
that has been the experience.
Right. So the chances of more permits being issued is very slim.
Yeah, in those fisheries that have been limited, say for example since 1975, we have seen a significant increase in the efficiency of the individual fishermen. As the permits are transferred, they're transferred into the hands of people who are more aggressive fishermen, who are making larger investments, spending more openings out there fishing than the people that originally held those permits. And we're seeing higher effort levels with the same number of permits. So if that were to happen out here in Norton Sound, that might absorb all the additional runs and would not allow us to issue more permits.
When you're doing this 195 figure, do you take into consideration that the people who live there are in the low poverty level? There's hardly any jobs, and it's about their only income is fishing. And as a result, some of the people who got maybe 8 or 9 points don't have sufficient points to go ahead and fish, but they're still dependent on fishing. The jobs don't exist at all.
Well, I didn't catch your name, but if, as I suggested, in the case of Norton Sound, we actually issued more permits than the number of people who made commercial landings in any year. We actually issued 7 more, we will issue 7 more permits than the number of commercial fishermen. So we would hope that anybody who was dependent upon that fishery, if you fished in 1975 alone and were dependent upon that fishery, for 60% of your income, that 1 year alone was sufficient to get you a permit. If you fished any two or three of the previous years, you could have gotten a permit. So I think our threshold level of permit issuance, I would hope anyway, that it's low enough that anybody who truly has been dependent upon that fishery would get a permit.
Okay, say somebody has 8 points, like if you say it's true, how would he go about getting the extra 2 points so he can be eligible to get a permit, if his whole lifestyle is dependent on fishing?
Well, if he believes that he has legitimate claims to additional points that the commission has not yet verified, there is a process that the commission has. It's called an adjudication process that allows us to go through individually with that person, his application, to hold a formal hearing with a hearing officer. The commission has, in the past, given fairly liberal evidence extension periods for people to get more evidence in to try to prove the points that they're claiming. If you in particular have an application in and you have 8 points, or somebody you know that's here, we'd be happy to talk with them.
Okay. Say we had 8 points, and he wasn't eligible for the extra points. He doesn't have. That's all he's got. How would he go about getting them?
Okay. The only way the commission gives out permits is by application to those people who are, you know, we rank order them according to points, and we give the top 195 people permits for Norton Sound. That's it. If this person wants a permit, then the only way for him to obtain one is to get one through the transfer process, which we'll be explaining.
Okay, once 195 is reached, that's it.
That's it.
I'm marking these down. I got you spotted. You're next, Mr. Foote.
My name is Bob Foote. I lived here in Newell Creek now for a little over 7 years. I've seen quite a bit of controversy and heard a lot more of the limited entry situation here. I've seen quite a number of things that I thought were totally unconstitutional. Number one, these fish belong to everyone. They don't belong to just the guy with the permit holder. I respect the Limited Entry Commission or the Fish and Game Department for their effort to keep a sustained yield of fish here. The last 3 years, we've had this tremendous improvement, increase in the number of fish, upriver, escapement. It's all been good. Now, this is very good. That part is fine. But I think the Limited Entry Commission has got their eyes shut on a lot of conditions and a lot of people here that are denied a right to their local fishing, way of life, to fish, earn a living, live through the winter without being on welfare, without being on the state. I think this the Limited Entry Commission, I have asked them, from Governor Hammond to Alan Daziak to Jim Larson to quite a number of people. I've had a lot of support here from the people here. And so far, all I've ever gotten from Limited Entry is the last words, if I can provide you with further information or otherwise be of assistance, please do not hesitate to write or call. That's the final sentence on every correspondence I've had. So far, that's about all the gratification that I've got. If you just try again, boy, try again. It gets a little bit monotonous to be trying again. There's a lot more people here that have tried again and again and again and have been denied. Stop cold. This is their right to fish. These are their fish. There's a lot of people here in town, in Unalakleet and all up the coast, that have got other means of livelihood than fishing. But they have a license. There's some families here that have 2 and 3 licenses in a family. I don't know whether this is right or not. That's not for me to judge. But there's other families with no. I don't want, please believe me, I don't want to fish myself. I don't intend to go out there and set it and everything else. I'm not interested in getting a permit for myself. I am for my wife. She's native. She was born and raised here. And I think she has a right to have that. I think there's a lot of people. Here's one man here. I don't know whether he has a permit or not, but there's a lot more people here that are born and raised here. And they're denied a right to make a living. They want to get married, or they are married, and they are denied the right to go fishing. They may have been in college. They may have been out working someplace else. They come back to live here. And they don't get that right to go and make a living here. I think the Limited Entry Commission has choked and restricted a lot of people that have a right to make a living in a decent manner. the way their friends and their relatives and everybody else have fished. They're denied. They're stopped cold, and they're not given a decent hearing. I think the Limited Entry Commission should come in here and individually, family by family, take a reading to see what the conditions are and check it and find out and see who, and then maybe they can get more realistic. For the village along the Bering Sea here, and the people here are restricted and stopped from making their decent way of living. I think it's wrong. I think the limited entry should fine them for Southeast Alaska, fine for down Bristol Bay. But up in this area here, we're small peanuts compared to the boys down there. Those people down there make $50,000, $180,000, whatever the, you know, up here, they're lucky to make $10,000, $12,000. This I disagree with. I think it should be, there's enough escapement. The only thing the fishing department should be concerned with here in this area is the escapement up the river, the hours fished, the nets out there in the water. Who catches those fish, I don't think should concern. It's the escapement up that river is what's paramount, so there'll be a return of fish and the legalities of the method of catching those fish. Who catches them, I think, is immaterial. Another thing, too, these issues, these permits here, this is a crab permit. It's not a king salmon, not a fisherman's. I can't go to fish, I don't want to. But my wife had one of these for 1975. She bought this, but she didn't buy a gear license, so she lost 3 points. But she did have this.
There weren't gear licenses in 1975.
No, big pardon?
There weren't gear licenses in 1975. That replaced it.
This replaced it in 1975? Why is she denied? Why is she denied her 3 points then? They denied it right here in this letter from Alan Nadeziak.
There's never been a point system established for king crab.
Not king crab. King. I'm talking about king salmon.
No, you said crab.
I know this is mine, but my wife's. I'm talking about my wife's.
Did she make any landings in 1975?
No, she didn't.
Okay. The law said that you had to participate in the fishery before you could get the permit. Just buying the piece of paper or the card wouldn't do it. You had to actually go out there and participate in the fishery to get participation points.
Why wasn't this law explained to the people then? This is as far as I'm concerned, after the fact.
You can see the potential abuse. If all you needed was to buy a piece of paper to get grandfathered into a fishery, what could possibly happen? So rather than just saying that if you bought the piece of paper, you got points, the legislature said you must be properly licensed and you must also fish.
That is not what it says here. She did not have a gear license holder. She was not a gear license holder. She was an interim permit holder for 1975. And it doesn't say one thing here about her landing a fish.
Mr. Foote, something's not meshing right here. So, well, I don't want to go through it right now, but if you will stick with us and during a coffee break or after the meeting.
I'm going to stick with you,
okay.
Believe me. Believe me. I'm going to stick with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob. I'm keeping track, everybody, hopefully. Jesse, you were next.
My name is Jesse Foster. There are several points I'd like to bring out in this method of application and processing using the facts that occurred before. Like in my hometown of Quinhock, last summer I looked at one of the permits and find out on the salmon permit that was issued, it was marked set salmon. That shows that one of the persons in my hometown received the set net permit. But those people in my home never set net before. All they do is drift gill net. And that person.
May I explain that, Jesse? On the Kuskokwim and Yukon rivers, we issue only one type of permit, and we have always called it a set net permit. But as you know, in the fish and game regulations, you're allowed to either set or drift with that permit. So it's a.
But the commissioner, there are two different types of the salmon permits. One is the drift salmon, which allows the person to drift the net while catching salmon commercially. The other one is the stamped set salmon, which means a person has to sit in it.
Yeah.
In doing that way, that's seem to be some kind of either application error either on the side of the applicant or on the commission side.
No, there's no in the Kuskokwim River and the Yukon River. If you buy a SetNet license or you get a SetNet permit from us, that our regulations and fish and game regulations allow you to either drift or set with that permit. In other parts of the state, there are distinct and separate fishing for set netting and drift netting, but that's not true of the Kuskokwim and Yukon Rivers. You can do either one with that permit.
One of the reasons I want to bring out is the problems which occur from the lack of understanding and of the language problems. Like most of the problems probably is usually occurred over here is due to the application errors, the mistakes in the application, which usually give the people less points than what they would actually earn if they have the education and understanding of the language in which the piece of paper the applicants is made of. To most of those people, to a lot of people who cannot read that piece of paper, they do not understand its contents or the importance of that paper. So the main problem is that it's usually disregarded or there are some application errors made while filling that because they do not understand what they are filling out. And as the result, there's probably some misunderstanding and wind up getting a lack of points. So I would recommend to the commission if they can review those applications where the people get less points, which would make them, which keep them from qualifying, see if they actually have enough points to qualify. From the statements I heard, some of those people have been fishing for a long time, and when it comes to getting enough points for them, there seem to be something wrong. Either that's the application error, which results on the side of the person who made that application, who sent that application, and now the commission knows this guy qualifies so many points. If there's something missing, that commission doesn't know it. It doesn't hurt the commission, but it hurts those people who depend on those permits to utilize those resources commercially.
Jesse, I'm sure that what you're saying has been and is presently true of a number of people. And I doubt if there's anything the commission could have done that would have guaranteed that everybody got the maximum number of points that they wanted. They did do a lot, though, and both within the system and beyond the system. In all of the Western Alaska fisheries, the commission contracted with agents who were familiar with the local areas to go out and provide application assistance. They went village to village, notified the people that were coming, informed them that they would be there to assist them in filling out the applications. Once the application was received by the commission, they looked at the forms, they looked at the state records, and they looked at the information that had accompanied the application. And using that information, they verified those point claims that they could. A letter went back to the applicant informing him of what points could be verified, telling him of what sorts of evidence would be needed to verify the rest of the points that he had claimed, also notifying him that if he did not believe that that classification was accurate, if it did not truly reflect his fishing history, that he could request a hearing. If he did request that hearing within a month and a half after he got the letter, then one of our hearing officers, especially in 1976 and 77 when we had a little money, would go on hearing trips. And Ron, have you been into the Enoclete on hearings before?
No.
Dave Ingram. We have had hearing officers into this area, all over Western Alaska, sitting down and holding formal hearings with people, asking them questions, asking them what sort of evidence they can produce regarding particular point claims, asking them what other persons might be familiar with their fishing history. To the best of our ability, trying to fully develop the record on these people. And that hearing officer then, if he could on his own verify sufficient points for that person to give them a permit, he was empowered to do that. If he could not, though, if it was a question regarding interpretation, for example, let's say the person didn't fish in 1975 because his wife was sick and he felt that he had to attend to her. There is a provision in our regulations that allows for unavoidable circumstances. If an unavoidable circumstance prevented you from fishing, you could be credited with points for fishing that year as if you were actually out there. In those questions as to whether or not it was unavoidable, the commission has to make a judgment decision. And the hearing officer writes up a recommended decision, submits it to the commissioners and back to the applicant. Everybody knows what his recommendation is. The applicant can then, at that time, request an oral appearance before the commissioners if he still does not agree with the recommended decision. And after that is all complete, the commission then finally decides what the classification point classification total is going to be for that applicant. If he's still not satisfied, he can appeal to the Superior Court. If he's not happy with the Superior Court's decision, he can appeal to the Supreme Court. And Mr. Foote, I can tell you that there is three cases before the Supreme Court right now questioning the constitutionality of limited entry.
There'd be more, too. Should be.
There's three presently. About the whole thing.
Again, there are differences in the regulatory process in reviewing those applications. Let's forget about the regulatory procedure and use just a plain common sense and how to best go about it. Now, if the commission allowed the nonprofits to review those applications, those people in the nonprofits are better qualified to review those permits, since they speak the same language and they understand the English language and they can also understand what the applications and the requirements are all about. They're in better position to review those applications if the commission will allow that, so the people who applied for those permits can better qualify. If they qualify for them, then they can qualify to their fullest benefit.
That would have been an allocation of authority that we could not have done, Jesse. The law required that we do that, that we review those applications and classify them.
Are you saying that the commission will allow the nonprofits of people using people who understand the language to go over those applications?
Those applications contain confidential information on them that we're not allowed to show to anybody outside of the commission. So we could not go through them with the nonprofit corporations, no.
The commissioner, there's a high possibility that there might be application error, which excludes those applicants from qualifying for those permits.
That's possible, yes.
Thank you, Jesse. I believe that you've been waiting quite a while.
Yes. My name is Marianne Hyman. And first, I'd like to say that we have never had a hearing here, or were limited entry people ever come here to explain anything.
I don't think that's true. There were at least two hearings before the regulations were adopted for this area in Uniloquit. I've read the transcripts of those hearings.
I've been a licensed vendor for this area since the mid-60s, and we have never had, I've never left the village, and we've never had anything. And I think a lot of these people will vouch for me. If they did, they came through, and maybe, I don't know what they did. But we've never had a public meeting or anything.
There were two, at least two public hearings before the regulations for this area were adopted. The hearings that I was talking about earlier when I was talking, responding to Jesse's question or comments, were hearings that are held with individual applicants. I mean, the applicant is notified that a hearing officer is coming, that he'll be in town, and that they're to get together at a particular time. It's an administrative hearing. There have also been public hearings in Uniloquit, though.
Not that I know of.
I read the transcripts before I came to this meeting.
What year?
1975.
Where at?
I don't know what building the meetings were held in. I can certainly check and see if I can find out.
Well, I don't think none of us knew about it.
Yeah.
My name's Paul Ivanoff. I did attend. There was two hearings, but there was no advertisement, no nothing. They just came in without advance warning that there was going to be a hearing, and I think that was wrong. That should have been fully advertised so that everybody would have known about it.
Bet you not.
Well, I can check our records and see what notice was required. The commission is required by law to provide notice of meetings, public hearings. And I'm just amazed that
another
they didn't do it adequately. Usually they use radio stations and newspapers.
You mentioned 1975, and that would have been too late anyway to have a commission hearing.
Why is that?
Because their reporting system ended in 1975.
Well, the regulations for this area were adopted in 1976, and the law says that the last year that counts is the year prior to the year the regulations are adopted. So the regulations were adopted in 1976. The hearings were held in 1975.
But I think what Marion Hogan is referring to is prior to the beginning of the point system. In other words, not like 1969, 1970 are the years that the commission should have been coming to Unalakleet and explaining to the people that these are the important years. Now, there is
the commission was informed until 1973.
Can I go on?
Yes, please go.
Okay. I've a paper here so I can go on. I've been a licensed vendor for Unalakleet since the mid-60s and sold commercial license to fishermen in Unalakleet, Shaktalik, and some in St. Michael. And we did not know that 1970 to 75 were the years that commercial fishermen were accumulating points. I would like to emphasize that we didn't know or were even aware that we fishermen were getting points. Nor did we know that when we voted for limited entry, we were closing the doors for our children to get permits. We were made to believe that by voting for limited entry, we were keeping persons from the lower 48 from coming to Alaska, making just for the fishing season and taking their monies back with them. They were just using our resources, but not helping our economic problems. I hope I've named some names here, and if I've used your name, forgive me. If I've excluded your name, it was because I couldn't think who was. Then there's some young boys like Tony and Michael Haugen, Steve Ivanov, Edgar Anagic, Albert and Alan Ivanov, Barry and Peter Nanov, who worked as helpers during 1970. In 1975, they should be given credit as apprentices. They were too young to get credit from stores or the fisheries to buy gear such as nets, anchors, buoys, boats, and outboard motors. Then there are those like myself and Lizzie Ivanov, Ruth Katungan, Francis Charles, Betty Anagic, Emily Nanau, Teresa Nanau, Pauline Sigunik, Laura Panichik, to name a few. We were wives. We could have been working on earning points had we known the intent of the state. Now our plight is different. We don't even have a record of being helpers because under the old manual and until 1978, a spouse who was not gainfully employed did not have to buy a helper's license. So we don't have anything. Then there are the young men too, like Gary Howden, Joel Uyamik, Berker Ivanov, Sam Tuara, Merlin Johnson, Ted Kauchik, and Morris Ivanov. They were drafted and were serving our country within this 5-year period. They're eligible for VA benefits, so couldn't the state give at least the sons of commercial fishermen within this period or those with a history of having fish honor points? And now we're faced with a problem like a man with 3 sons and 1 permit, all 4 willing and wanting to fish, with our high rate of unemployment and most of the work being seasonal, we would like an option to fish. Fish and Game controls the opening and closure periods, and they know just how much is being harvested. So it's not like us wanting to deplete or even endanger our salmon industries. On September 4th, we had a city council meeting. and the consensus was that the residents of Union Creek be given the option to fish. We're not asking for a handout. Fishing is hard work. Now, as it is now, permits are sold for thousands of dollars, and most of them being bought by outsiders. And this is something, and nothing is done for our local economy. They take their money out with them. And this is what we were voting against to begin with when we thought we were voting against the limited entry. And I was wanting to know the guideline for issuing permits. Did you use Bristol Bay area, the Yukon Delta area, Southeast Alaska? It's not fair for us. We don't get all that much money, but you mostly covered it there. And what are your rules for issuing interim use permits? Some get interim use permits with 3 points. Some with 9 points are denied. So is it first come, first serve basis?
Nobody with 9 points should have been denied an IUP, an interim use permit, for this fishery.
I have heard some that have been denied that.
I would be interested in knowing those people. Interim use permits, the commission issues two types of interim use permits. The first type is issued in those fisheries that are not subject to limitation, like the crab fishery and the herring fishery. Interim use permits are used in limited fisheries, like salmon. And they're issued to those people who have not yet been classified at a point level to get a permanent permit, but still have a possibility of achieving that level, either because they're still in a hearing process, or there's more evidence coming in on their claim, or because they have been classified at a point level which could conceivably receive a permit once everybody else has been decided. And the 9-point people in Norton Sound, if I've read my papers properly, are at a level that it is uncertain whether or not they will get permits. Consequently, 9-point classification should have gotten interim use permits and should still be getting them. If I can respond to your other comments, Marianne, if there were a way that the state could say that people that fished in Norton Sound had to live in Norton Sound, obviously that would be better than limited entry for this area. It would be a much better system. The local residents could all fish. You could decide basically within your various families who would fish and who would not. And it would work. The United States Constitution does not allow the state or anybody else to do that. It is a common property resource. Consequently, the state or nobody else can restrict anyone's access to that resource legally.
But I think that's discrimination. First,
it's discrimination the other way. You're discriminating against people that don't live here.
That's discrimination in my book.
Just take this.
Yeah, John, why was...
I got you. No. Go ahead.
My name is Simon Fusak. There's one thing I do know, I'd like everyone of us to get our attention to. A lot of these laws are made elsewhere to provide for those people, maybe down the road 48 or elsewhere. And then they are being enforced here. That's where a lot of our problems come in. A lot of the problems for some of the people don't know. Those laws illuminate. Let me take one of my schoolmates. He fished ever since he was born, ever since he was a kid. And I'm sure he fished every season when the canneries were here. When point system came, he wound up with only 9 points. And I understand that he fished himself. He didn't get to fish. Now, I'm really glad to see a study commission here in our representative. Let me say this. I've been going after my permits all summer, chasing all over the country. I always took myself as an aborigine, born and raised over here, what happens, I go to these people. They tell me, well, this and that, and you know, this and that, so forth. Fine, because all those laws are made elsewhere, and they're being enforced here. So I would like to see, I would like to focus the attention to the study commission and to you, representative. Problems I had every time I went to some commissioner, they tell me those laws were made. And then one time I went to a lawyer, he told me I couldn't change the laws. I'm not here to change the laws. I'm here to protect them. All right. Now with our study committee and our representative, if we would go about from here on, first we recognize the appreciation. The person that was born and raised here. And all these problems could be solved if they were properly executed. Thank you.
Jack, if I can answer a couple more questions.
Yeah, if you're through with there. Marianne, I don't think that you got an answer to your question. I've got two more people. Clarence, you're next, and you're next, and I'll write you down.
Okay. A couple of more comments that you made that I didn't respond to. The first one is regarding people that were drafted into the military. If people had a fishing history, worked as operators of gear prior to the time they were drafted, then we credited them with fishing during the years that they were drafted as if they had been fishing, even though they were gone, under unavoidable circumstance claims. Now, those points are available only for the first hitch. In other words, if you re-upped, then that was a choice that you made on your own, and unavoidable circumstance points were not available. If you were drafted or enlisted, as if you were drafted, then you got points for the years you were in the military. Two other points that you made are two points that have been probably the two biggest problems with the limited entry system involve getting the kids in fishing and the high values of permits. And rather than just pass over that, I wonder if Ella might want to comment on exactly what the legislature's study group is doing this summer. And I can tell you that they're very much looking at those two areas very heavily. How's that for a lead-in?
Excuse me? The limited entry study group was set up by the legislature, and the study group itself is looking at a lot of the major problems that the system has. Because of the fact that there are so many different administrative areas for the fisheries, like there's the Norton Sound, the Bristol Bay, the Cook Inlet, the Prince William. A lot of these fisheries are different. But some of the main priorities that the study group is looking at very seriously is the high value of the permit. Because of that high value of the permit, a lot of the permits are leaving a lot of the villages. So we're looking at possibly knocking out the value of this permit completely. Another thing that we are looking at is setting up an apprenticeship program, because it's very hard for the young people to enter into the fisheries. For one thing, in some of the other areas in the state, the permit has gone up to like $75,000 to $100,000. The third thing that we're also looking at is the economic and the socioeconomic impacts, to look at the economic situation within some of the villages where fishing is a major source of livelihood, where people, because there aren't any other available alternative occupations, people have to depend pretty heavily on fishing. Now, a lot of this stuff we're trying to put together before the end of December, and a lot of it I've got to, before it can be released to the public, some of the major revisions that the study group is thinking of, it has to go through the committee members. Representative Jack Fuller is a member of the committee of the Legislative Limited Interim Committee, and he's been getting a lot of the materials that we've been compiling. Nels Anderson from Bristol Bay is the chairman of this committee. Terry Gardner from the Southeast, and there's Sumner from Cook Inlet, Bill Sumner, Bob McCahey from Kodiak. But a lot of this material that we're compiling, it has to go, because it's so politically sensitive, it has to go to the committee, and the committee will, they'll look through it,